there. You're listening to Film Spotting, Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore, and we are here every other week to talk about streaming movies, series, and everything in between. On this episode of Film Spotting SVU, we'll be getting both paranoid about and choked up over The Iron Giant, the 1999 animated film from director Brad Bird that's been on our mind for reasons beyond just the fact that it was recently added on Netflix.
Yep, Bird's got a new movie in theater soon, Incredibles 2. And more importantly, The Iron Giant recently featured prominently, and not without some controversy, in Steven Spielberg's reference-heavy Ready Player One, which turned the pacifist character into the avatar of someone using it pretty much as a laser-eyed killing machine.
And boy, are there people on the internet that do not like it when you point out that irony.
Well, rather than turn the second half of this episode over to retorts to you haters, Allison, as you suggested, we're going to accentuate the positive and recommend some other movies that get referenced in Ready Player One, all available to rent or stream at home right now. And maybe we'll get to some discussion of Spielberg's latest while we're at it, too. But first, let's talk The Iron Giant.
Ago, SATCOM radar detected an unidentified object entering Earth's atmosphere.
Invaders from Mars!
Some assumed it was a large meteor or a downed satellite. This is no meteor, gentlemen. This is something much more dangerous.
So, I guess you're not gonna hurt me, huh?
This is unbelievable. This is the greatest discovery since television or something.
Hey, big metal guy! I got food here for you!
My own giant robot. I am now the luckiest kid in America.
Banzai!
Here's how things work here at Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. You, the listener, tell us what you'd like us to review next. At the end of each episode, we give you three different films or shows and let you vote on which one you'd like to hear us talk about. Last time, your choices were Brad Bird's The Iron Giant, recently added to Netflix, Derek Comedy's Mystery Team on Amazon, and the 80s cult favorite Night of the Comet on Tubi TV. And while The Iron Giant and Mystery Team were neck and neck for most of the period the poll was running, Donald Glover's comedy couldn't beat out the animated behemoth. It's worth noting that when it came out in 1999, The Iron Giant was a huge critical hit and a box office flop. People just didn't have a lot of interest in this movie at the time, about this boy and his robot, this adventure taking place during the Cold War in the 1950s. The film was Brad Bird's directorial debut. He'd come up as an animator at Disney in the 80s, and then he'd worked on and helped shape the look of The Simpsons during its first 8 years. The Iron Giant shows an interest in this kind of throwback sci-fi that would go on to inform a lot of Bird's later work. You know, you can think of the mid-century modern stylings of The Incredibles, or the kind of nostalgic optimism for the future that's in Tomorrowland. But The Iron Giant is where it all began, with a boy named Hogarth Hughes, what a name to be saddled with, encountering a massive metal-eating robot from space in the woods outside of his small Maine town. The robot, voiced by Vin Diesel, is really lovable, childlike, and extremely weaponized. He usually doesn't mean to cause the sometimes large-scale destruction he can be prone to. But he does end up on the radar of a government agent named Kent Mansley, voiced by Christopher McDonald, whose insistence on protecting the country sometimes seems more like a hunger for war. There's also Hogarth's mom, a waitress at the local diner, who's voiced by Jennifer Aniston. And there's also the town beatnik, voiced by Harry Connick Jr. But mostly, the film is about Hogarth and the giant, who form a sweet bond of trust at a time when everyone else is feeling paranoid, doubting each other, and sure they're about to get attacked. Like many children's movies, The Iron Giant has a message. Unlike many children's movies, that message is not one about self-acceptance or loving yourself or believing in yourself, being kind to others. It is explicitly anti-violence. Guns kill, and you don't have to be a gun, Hogarth tells a giant after they witness a deer being killed by hunters in the woods, and basically teaches the giant about death. Matt, it pains me to say this, but watching this movie, I could not help but think that if The Iron Giant came out in 2018,
yes,
it would not struggle to get press coverage.
I was thinking this too. Yeah. Go ahead.
This is a message that certain outlets would use as an enraged talking point for days and days.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I guess my question for you is, like, how radical do you feel it is to have this as the message of a children's film?
It's funny. I thought the exact same thing. I was like, if this movie came out now, there would be Twitter protests. There would be angry right-wing Twitter users who would devote weeks of their life to, like, destroying this movie.
The NRA would
organize a boycott of Warner Brothers Studio for this incredibly heartfelt, beautiful animated movie. For sure. Like, there's no doubt in my mind. And I had not seen this movie in a very long time. I had to be reminded after I had seen Ready Player One that it was about a character who is a pacifist, or, like, learns to be a pacifist, or to embrace love and friendship and all those sorts of things. I didn't really remember that he wasn't, like, an evil killbot. That had eluded me. So rewatching it, the first thing that struck me was just how kind of radical in and of itself it was to see this little boy running around with a gun. How we wouldn't, like, no movie studio would go near that image in 2018. And then, of course, we see that that's a very deliberately chosen image, because this movie is all about guns and about violence. And as you said, like, choosing not to be a gun, choosing not to embrace violence, choosing to reject those impulses. So, yeah, it's pretty radical. I mean, it's funny how I don't remember it being considered that way in 1999. I remember it being, you know, sort of this cult movie that came and went very quickly in theaters, but within a year or two had sort of already accrued this reputation at the time. It was mostly on VHS. I mean, DVD was barely even a thing at that point, as this sort of very beautiful, almost like too beautiful for this world studio film.
Yep.
But now in 2018, it genuinely does look like a radical film. I think that's the perfect word for it. I was sitting there watching it on Netflix going, no one would make this movie today. And not because it's a little bit of a bummer at the end, but because of the themes, the ideas in it.
Yeah, it is. It's funny to say that a movie that is kind of anti-violence is it's like a wild yeah. thing to say, but it is. It's specifically anti-violence within the context of weapons as well.
Right. Well, and it's not. It's not subtext. It's right. text. That's the thing. It's not like you could read this as a story about guns or something. It is foregrounded in the film. It is about guns and weapons and violence.
Yeah. And it you know, I think this movie is so kind of emotionally, like, devastating and just emotionally kind of rich. It's a really simple story, really. Like, which was, like, the surprise to me rewatching it is how kind of how few developments there were, you know, that it's very straightforward. And yet I think that, like, that ending works so incredibly well.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was, and yet it did feel shocking. I don't think, like, certainly the movie hasn't changed since then.
Right.
But we have changed in how we talk about media and what we tolerate in terms of messaging and what people get very angry about now.
Right.
It was kind of heartening to me, like, to see something that took such a, like, explicit stroke, explicit message, and especially in a kid's film.
Right.
I don't think that saying, you know, violence is
violence
bad.
Is bad.
That, like, death is a part of life.
Yes.
But violence is bad, causing
right.
the death
of others.
That's a choice. Yes.
Yeah.
It's kind of
what a despicable person Brad Bird is to foist these messages and brainwash our children.
Yeah. Well, and also I had forgotten this, but they show the duck and cover video, like,
yes.
the version of the duck and cover video, and mm-hmm. the kind of, like, deep irony to it. Like, obviously there were real duck and cover videos, and there were real public service messages that informed people to do doomed things that would not help them if they were directly hit by a nuclear bomb. But I think it's a pretty, like, dark image to include in a children's film.
Oh, yeah.
Even if a child might not fully understand the context of what they're being taught.
I think they get away with it because I don't think a child would understand it today, then or today. I think that's one thing that is specifically there for the adults in the room. The parents are going to get that, but the children, I think for the most part that would go over their heads.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't show this movie to my daughter.
Do you think she's not? Do you think she would not be able to?
She definitely
it?
Would. She wouldn't grasp that part for
no,
sure.
But
I mean, the story. I don't know. It's a good question. I think she, I don't know if she'd be able to handle emotionally the ending, even though it has that sweet coda,
right?
That sort of twist where it's not quite as despairing as it seems
yes.
for a few minutes. I do sort of. I don't know. I don't think she's ready for the Iron Giant just yet.
Yeah, it is. And I know that like Bird has made this explicit comparison, but it is very E.T. like even
yes.
in the
setting.
Sad ending that's saved at the
right.
very end.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that relationship there's I mean, it's very there's something very kind of classic of this. It's a boy and his kind of like monster, his outsized friend, otherworldly friend. But I love the giant. Like, the giant is so endearing.
Yep.
And this, like, gravelly Vin Diesel voice, distorted, you know, being explained the difference between rocks and trees is, like, just, it's so, to have this creature that, whose, like, destructive powers are never softened. Like, it's, even when, before he reveals the fact that he turns into a horrifying weapon when threatened, like, he causes all kinds of huge damage. Just by being large
yeah,
and not
on
knowing.
Purpose.
Yeah. But he's so cute.
he is cute. And he's also, I thought, incredibly well animated. The yeah. stiffness of him. The you feel the weight of him and the way that he lumbers through the forest. And the sound design. The way that, you know, you're mentioning how he's causing all this damage. The just the bangs and the way the ground shakes when he walks because he's so heavy. And the stiffness in his joints. And yeah, just and the way that he moves through the space. I mean, for an animated movie, a 2D animated movie, I just, you know, where so much of 2D animation traditionally that we think of, you know, Disney cartoons and Looney Tunes, where nothing has like physics. Everything is elastic and bendy and stretchy. And, you know, the Roadrunner can throw the coyote off the cliff and, you know, it doesn't mean anything. And there's such a weight and a presence to the Iron Giant. Like, I can't really think of too many other animated movies, I guess 2D or 3D, where, like, the characters have such a weight to them. And I really appreciated that this time rewatching it, is that the character is so beautifully designed and then so beautifully executed in the way that it moves. I mean, rewatching this movie, my only complaint was it's too short. You mentioned it's under 90 minutes.
Yeah,
and
it happens very quickly.
Yeah, and I mean it's like a perfect little nugget of a movie, but I get what's that expression, you know, no good movie is too long, no bad movie is too short. I would love if this movie was 15 minutes longer and we could just see one extra scene with all the characters and all their relationships, like more of the giant and Hogarth, more of Hogarth's mom, who I think is a really interesting character who doesn't really get a ton of screen time, more of the beatnik, you know, more of all and all their relationships. Like, everything works, everything makes sense. It's not like you can't buy anything or anything happens too quickly, but I feel like the movie would be even more of a gut punch, even more emotionally moving, if we got like 10, 15 more minutes with these characters to really like just soak in the world and the relationships and watch them sort of grow over time.
Well, you only really get this one, the sequence where they're swimming is like the real moment in which the movie relaxes into these characters just hanging out.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful scene. But you're right. It doesn't get a lot of time to really allow them to just spend time together before the plot is in motion.
It's a lot of plot in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, for a very short movie, and it's almost all plot. I think you pinpointed like one of the few scenes where we're just allowed to enjoy the relationship between the boy and the Iron Giant, where I think most people watching it would gladly take like 3 or 4 more scenes just of that.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about, I mean, this movie plays, as I mentioned before, Bird has this real interest in like maybe a 50s idea of the future. I think it's clearly like 50s sci-fi, retro sci-fi is his like favorite sensibility. And, you know, this movie plays into a lot of kind of like classical Americana, like this idyllic small town.
Yep.
It's very autumnal.
It's called Rockwell. I don't think that's an
Rockwell,
accident.
Maine. Yeah, exactly. It's very Norman Rockwell. That has, you know, the town oddballs and all of that, but it's still like a community. And
I think Andy Griffith Show.
Yes. And then at the same time, the robot is also an image out of like kind of a classic classic, you know, in this case, like a robot attacking, right? This, I just like, I do appreciate the ways in which he uses this imagery and understands where it like fits in our kind of like collective nostalgia so well. And yet, also pokes at it a bit, you know, the character in this, the villain in this is, yet another kind of wholesome seeming, you know, character, this government guy who wants to be everyone's friend, but is also this warmongering.
Kent Mansley.
Yes.
Perfectly cast. Christopher McDonald, Shooter McGavin. So excellent voice.
Yeah. I don't always love like Bird's effect, like kind of interest in. I think like Tomorrowland was maybe the movie that really tested how you feel about Bird's affection for retrofuturism.
Right.
But I think that like in this movie in particular, he uses it so well. He just likes the look of all of this, the kind of, and the feel of that kind of vision of the future so much.
He has an aesthetic. There's no question about it. Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I also agree that Tomorrowland is kind of insufferable. I mean, yes. It's an incredibly like ambitious movie, and it's like it's a hard movie to dislike, and yet I dislike it.
I dislike it too, yes.
which is sort of interesting in and of itself. But you're right, it is, they are all of a piece in terms of he's fascinated with the past's vision of the future. And this sort of collision between, I mean, in this movie it's crystal clear, this collision between this sort of very nostalgic, Americana was a word used, which I absolutely think I, you know, came to my mind watching it, this kind of idyllic version of Americana butting up against these sort of different ideas about who we are as a society or as a nation or as a culture. I mean, in this movie, it's very much about like these, this collision between this idyllic Americana and also this paranoia, this fear of the other, of the unknown, you know, and how these things basically coexisted in the 1950s in this country. But like when we remember them as like two separate things. And this movie is trying to reconcile them and remember them together.
And also you have the beatnik, like, you know, there are other characters who could have been an outsider. It's very consciously choosing to have this character be a beatnik to like, as a reminder that also the 50s give way to the 60s and all the kind of upheaval and social unrest and kind of like social change that came at that time.
Right.
And so it's like all kind of they're complicating what is, you know, supposed to be this very nostalgic portrait of a town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can see some of that in The Incredibles also. I was going to say The Incredibles 2. Now I have to be more specific. The Incredibles, comma, 2. in terms of it's again, it's like mid-century modern. It's this, you know, classical vision with a kind of a futuristic spy movie kind of energy
chrome,
to it.
A little chrome.
Yeah. And it's sort of like the again, like the past's vision of the future. And that in that movie, it's kind of going up against, I don't know, you know, government meddling or government overregulation or whatever you want to say. There's that whole subplot in that movie about, you know, if everyone is special, then no one is, which, you know, became very controversial. But yeah, it's definitely something that he's kind of returned to again and again, maybe to some degree with diminishing returns. I'm not sure he's ever made a better movie, as much as I love the first Incredibles. And even his Mission Impossible movie is a lot of fun, too,
sure.
Which is also like a 60s vision of the future in a way. While I like all those movies, I'm not sure he's ever made anything sort of more perfect in its own little way. It does feel like kind of a little movie than The Iron Giant.
Yeah, it's pretty wonderful. So having gone back and looked at it again.
Yes.
How did you feel about how The Iron Giant is deployed in Ready Player One?
Oh, it's a complete disgrace. It is absolutely a betrayal, 100%. Yes. And like I said, when I saw the movie, it's been so long since I'd seen The Iron Giant that it literally didn't faze me at all. I thought, oh, wow, it's cool to see The Iron Giant. Look at him go. He's, you know, it's kind of fun. It's part of this whole crazy battle. No problems with it whatsoever. Now I'm sitting here like retroactively stewing, going, that was awful. How could Steven – like it is a betrayal of like – I don't – does Steven Spielberg have beef? With Brad Bird?
It does. It feels like there's something there where you kind of wonder, it's not just a character who's like incongruous in this world. It is really like a fundamental choice going against the message of the movie.
Right. I mean, the only thing you can say is that there is that subtext in Ready Player One about creations and their creators and the question of what happens when someone creates something and lets it go. and what happens to it then. And you could argue that the most painful depiction of that in the movie is the Iron Giant, because it is made by someone other than its creator, and it is a complete just mockery of what the movie is about. And so in a way, it's kind of horrifying, and in a way, it's kind of poignant and maybe speaking to the themes of the movie. I don't know if I totally buy that, but that's sort of the devil's advocate argument I could make for it.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, if you, too, want to reexamine your feelings about either the Iron Giant or...
Or just cry.
Yes, or just cry.
Because it's always good for a cry.
I definitely cried.
Superman.
Oh, God. The Iron Giant is streaming on Netflix.
All right. So let's talk about some other movies that are referenced in Ready Player One. Actually, let's talk about all the movies referenced in Ready Player One. Let's do an 18-hour podcast. Systematically go through them all.
I've read multiple lists. There are different ones to different degrees of like explanation and exhaustion.
Yes.
Yes. And there are like many in there that I was like, I didn't catch that at all.
We did a list, a video list you can find at youtube.com/screencrush, where basically me and my video editor both individually saw the movie and wrote down every one we could find. And it's long. It's like we found like, I don't know, 70 references, and it's like a 10-minute long video. And then I was looking today a couple of days ago to find movies to talk about, looking to see what my options were for this podcast. I'm like, oh, I didn't see that reference. Oh, yep. I didn't see that. And there was like at least 10 that I didn't catch. And I caught like dozens and dozens and dozens. So what I'm saying is Ready Player One is a masterpiece, Allison, because I value movies based on how much they reference other movies.
I think the weird thing about Ready Player One, and I've talked about it on this podcast briefly, but you have not yet. You hadn't seen it at the time.
Okay.
It suggests that there's the world, it's not just that this world is filled with references, but that in some ways references are almost all people can make. It feels like there's nothing new anymore or nothing original.
Mm.
That the world is like told entirely through references to other things. That's the strangest thing to me about the Iron Giant being used as an avatar. It's not just that it was someone who is clearly either ignored the context of of the movie or really like to kind of spite the context of the movie.
Yeah.
But is that like, why would someone want the Iron Giant? Like, it just, you know, I'm just like,
if you love the Iron Giant, what you don't want out of the Iron Giant is to use him as a death laser.
Right.
You would want to like play with him.
Yes.
And like go to the lake and have him be your friend. And yeah, exactly. Like watch him chew metal, I guess.
Right.
You wouldn't necessarily want to use him to destroy Mechagodzilla.
Yeah.
Let's say. And as a hypothetical example.
And the world of Ready Player One is like, it's half a particular person's nostalgia. It is this fictional character's nostalgia / Ernest Cline, the author's nostalgia, as tweaked by Steven Spielberg.
Right.
But it's also then presumably the people using the Oasis, this VR world, it's presumably their nostalgia and their childhood
right.
as well.
And that doesn't really make sense.
It doesn't really make sense.
Right. We should explain. If you haven't seen Ready Player One, right, it's set in a future. I think the year is like 2045. And it's set in this world where this virtual reality landscape exists called the Oasis, where you can go in there and basically be anyone, do anything you want to do, which mostly involves like video gaming, like death matches and surfing and racing games and all these sorts of things. But for some reason, even though it's the year 2045, all of the references, all of the sort of fixations of the people in that are using the Oasis are mostly 80s and 90s. There's a lot of 90s in there,
yes,
too. I haven't read the book.
90s. I have read the book. Right. It definitely has been updated a bit more and like opened up a bit more, the
right.
references.
It was more like sort of like old video games, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And some movies.
Yes. The book very much kind of reflects Ernest Cline, the author's taste, as like a guy who was a teenager in the 80s in the Midwest.
Right.
You know, his particular music that he liked and the video games that he played and
right.
the movies that he memorized and the TV that he watched.
Right. You know? It's like, on the one hand, it's incredibly canny in terms of selling something because he's making it for an audience like himself that's going to love those references. From a plot perspective, it really doesn't make sense that people in 2045 are so into like adventure on Atari. Like, why would they care? Other than, you know, they try to explain it that the creator of the Oasis loved this stuff and that therefore they are obsessed with it because they're trying to figure out his will and yada, 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 yada.
Yeah. Well, so I was looking through the references, and
yes,
I wanted to
so
pick some
I.
that struck me. Oh, but before we also do this, the okay. ones that kind of jumped out to me as like maybe weird.
Incongruous?
Or, yes.
Okay, let's hear.
But before we do this also, I did want to say, for all that the Iron Giant, like the Iron Giant being this weapon annoyed me in the movie.
Yes.
You know, one of the biggest set pieces, and clearly I would say the best part of the movie, is also a repurposing of a classic work of cinema.
Absolutely.
For ways that are totally not what the creator would have intended.
For sure.
And it's delightful. It's like blasphemously delightful.
Yes. That's a good way to put it. It was absolutely my favorite part of the movie.
Right. Which is like the potential, I think, for the like, best and worst parts of Ready Player One, which is like the same thing. Repurposing of references can be horrible and can be kind of wonderful.
Well, I mean, not to get off on too much of a tangent, but I mean, that is kind of remix culture in a nutshell, right? Like people love a song that samples a song from the past, and the new song you could love or you could hate, and the creator might have nothing to do, the original creator might have nothing to do with it, and they might not like the new song that becomes a huge hit. They may have nothing to do with it. They may have no control over it.
Yep.
The Iron Giant may become a death laser. I don't know. It's sort of the same thing.
Well, I wanted to point out for my first reference.
Okay.
Daito, one of the two characters from different parts of Asia who are friends of... It doesn't really matter. they're side characters.
Yes.
One of them, in fulfilling the race that is the first challenge in Ready Player One, he makes it to the end with his car like on fire. But what car is that, Matt? It is a 1977 Pontiac Firebird Trans Am.
Oh.
As driven by Burt Reynolds
in
Smokey and the Bandit.
This is a reference I actually did not spot myself until I saw it on IMDb.
And I have to say, that is one of the weirder references to be thrown into this melange of different kind of pop culture, you know, bits and pieces that get thrown in here. It's not, I would say, within the realms of a classically nerdy movie, though I absolutely accept that it is a movie that people feel nostalgia for, it feels like the kind of movie that was maybe almost nostalgic when it was made. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's this kind of cozy movie about this kind of fictionalized vision of the South and of trucking and of this kind of, I don't know, like, good old boy racing movie, like across the country or half the country. If you have not seen it, this is the 1977 film starring Burt Reynolds and Sally Field. I think they became an item during the filming of this movie.
I believe you're correct.
Directorial debut of Hal Needham, who was a stuntman. And it is mostly a movie about driving. Mm-hmm. It is a movie about how the bandit, played by Burt Reynolds, takes a bet to bootleg a truck full of Coors beer, the finest beer available in the U.S. at the time, I guess. had a very good reputation. You could not buy it to the east of the Mississippi.
Yeah.
So these rich dudes in Atlanta make a bet with Bandit to go out to Texas, Texarkana, buy a truck full of Coors, and then race it back to Atlanta against all regulations,
right?
So that these guys can have a party and enjoy their Coors.
Makes sense.
That's it. That's
the movie.
The whole movie is the bandit and his friend driving out and then incurring the wrath of various patrolmen who try to chase him down, and then one in particular on the way back. As he also picks up Sally Field as a runaway bride. But mostly, I mean, there's, for a movie that is about a car chase, really, there's so little urgency to Smokey and the Bandit. Mm. You know, they keep stopping for little adventures or to have an assignation in which he takes his hat off. The only reason that he'll ever take his hat off, the bandit. But the kind of like warm coziness of this movie, in which all of the characters along the road come out to help the bandit because he's such a local legend, you know, including the sex workers and including the funeral procession and including fellow truckers and the teens. They'll all like help him out by blocking all the cops. Everyone no matter who they are along the road, they all hate the cops. But I, you know, I, it's such a kind of pleasure to watch because it's so little of a movie in terms of story and so much of a movie just in terms of its atmosphere and watching its two main characters just delight in each other as like two kind of show-offy, impulsive people who seem weirdly perfect for each other. And I don't really understand how it fits into Ready Player One, except that maybe they just needed another
famous car vehicle. I think you're right.
Yes. And there are only so many fast cars in the history of movies that might be recognizable. But I don't know. Maybe Daito was also a huge Burt Reynolds fan. There are much weirder things in the world.
I mean, it is a very pleasurable movie.
Yes.
I enjoy Smokey and the Bandit.
Yes.
And it's not a movie that I'm nostalgic for because I never saw it as a kid. I only saw it a couple of years ago for the first time. And I thought this is incredibly delightful because everyone in the movie is having fun.
Everyone's having a great time.
Great time.
But I think that when you look at, say, like David Gordon Green's movies and like the types, when he has this kind of like pang for, I think, like making a 70s Burt Reynolds movie.
Yeah.
Or when you look at Logan Lucky, which, you know, feels in some ways like it has aspirations towards being a 70s Burt Reynolds movie. I think that the feel of a movie like this has seeped into, even though there's not a lot of space for it, for a movie like this right now, there is like a longing for in some filmmakers to just try and figure out a way to do something like this.
It's not easy. It looks easy.
It looks easy.
But it is not.
It is not. In some ways, it's easier to sign on to a Ready Player One than it is to try and make something like this now. But that is Smokey and the Bandit. It is available for rent.
So in the Oasis in Ready Player One, there are many vehicles and weapons and references to other movies. And then sometimes we just straight up see characters from other movies. And within this universe of Ready Player One, the idea is these are avatars. People have chosen to embody within this virtual world these other existing fictional characters. And I thought that was one of the more realistic parts of the movie because I absolutely believe that if VR existed as it does in The Oasis in this movie, people would do this. People would not only want to look like their favorite characters, they would want to act like them. They would want to become them, even like slasher horror film villains, for example. I absolutely thought that was 100% true to life. I think a lot of people, even some we would qualify as mentally healthy, would kind of get off on pretending to be their favorite horror movie bad guy slaughtering people, free of any real world repercussions. And one such horror movie bad guy who makes a very prominent cameo in Ready Player One is Jason Voorhees from the Friday the 13th franchise. And maybe it because it was Friday the 13th last week when we are recording this, I thought, why not recommend a Friday the 13th movie? I have previously recommended my favorite film in the series, Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives, that came up on a previous episode during a Behind the 8 Ball segment. So instead, I went with my second favorite Jason movie, which is Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter, which in true schlock horror fashion was not the final chapter. In fact, there's like 7 or 8 more movies after it so far. The Final Chapter was actually the fourth film in the series. And for my money, it is the best straight horror movie among the Friday the 13th oeuvre, the one that I like even more. Jason Lives is much more tongue-in-cheek. It's kind of a horror spoof. It's basically Scream a full decade before that movie was made. The Final Chapter is really a straight-ahead slasher movie. Scary, gross, and very effective in its own way. And it is also the movie in the franchise that really like cemented the formula that would carry Jason from this point basically until the end. The first movie, spoiler alert, didn't even have Jason Voorhees as the killer. In the second movie, he has a flannel shirt and a bag over his head the whole time. Very scary. Very scary. Surprisingly, that look didn't last. It's the third movie where he first got the hockey mask. And then this movie, Final Chapter, is really where they brought it all together with very inventive and gory kills. Practical makeup master Tom Savini was the designer of all the special effects in this film, and he outdid himself. They are super gnarly. And you also have a very good cast of young actors, including Corey Feldman and a young pre-Back to the Future Crispin Glover, who in probably the film's most famous or at least most memed, internet memed scene, dances to 80s music. Have you ever seen his dance in Friday the 13th?
I have not.
Oh, I'll show it. We're going to look it up after this segment, okay. And you're going to laugh because it is quite a thing. Is this movie sleazy? You betcha. Jason kills a guy who's swimming by stabbing him in the crotch with a harpoon gun. This movie, a picture of it, any still really from it, could be used in the dictionary next to the definition of the word sleaze. But it is well-made sleaze. And in terms of Ready Player One, getting back to the again, this is absolutely something I am a little nostalgic for. My parents were fairly protective of me when it came to adult content in movies. And so the first time I ever saw a horror movie was at a sleepover, and I vividly remembered it wasn't this particular Friday the 13th. It was Part 7, The New Blood. That's the one where they had – there's the girl with the telekinetic powers, Allison. And that movie is not very good. But to this day, I remember vividly watching it at Jason Wiener's house.
Wow. That guy running crazy over there. No rules.
In his basement, just a bunch of dorks in sleeping bags up at 2:30 in the morning watching a VHS tape someone rented of Friday the 13th Part 7, The New Blood. And maybe it is weird to be nostalgic for an unstoppable zombie killer who dresses like a janitor who's also really into hockey, but I am. And while I would not recommend a lot of the movies in the Friday the 13th franchise, if you are looking for this kind of movie, I think the best one, at least that's like a straight, non-winking horror movie, is The Final Chapter. And I don't think I mentioned earlier, it is available right now for rent, or it is also available on Stars. Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter.
So one of the strange things about Ready Player One's references is that, well, one, they're being chosen in part by someone who has participated in making a lot of the movies that the kind of era of the book would want to reference. But also that because this is a movie being produced by Giant Studio, it is subject to corporate licensing. And yes. So a lot of the references that get chosen kind
Warner
of depend,
Brothers.
Yes. Or like whatever, whoever they could get the relationships with as well.
Right.
And I did think it was interesting in one of the like kind of more prominent references, the type, the incarnation of this character that they chose. That reference would be King Kong, who features prominently in the race that I talked about before, which is like the first challenge. King Kong is the creation that, or the character that people who get to the end of the race have to deal with. And he's, you know, kind of like playing a goalie at the end of the race for anyone who makes it that far. But King Kong, who is in Ready Player One, is not, I think, pretty clearly the 1933 King Kong, who tends to stand on his back two legs and kind of stand up more like a person. He is the Peter Jackson King Kong. He is the 2005 version of the giant ape. And there's something kind of funny about that, to be like... in the future, who is the King Kong that we remember? Not the 1933 classic.
Right.
Not Kong Skull Island.
Nope.
There is no memory of Kong Skull Island in the future. It got wiped out.
Yep.
It is only the 2005 version that has survived.
Right.
And I do think the 2005 film is very good. You can stream it on Netflix right now. It is in kind of true Peter Jackson form. And I think it's funny to kind of miss Peter Jackson since it's not like he really went away, but he's been making movies that I had not a great deal of interest in for the past few years. But this King Kong is, you know, kind of half a horror movie in addition to all of the kind of classic adventure stuff and the classic 'twas beauty that killed the beast storyline. There's a reason that they're not going with a Kong Skull Island version of King Kong. You know, in updating King Kong, for good reason, the new movie kind of tried to deal with or sand away or kind of reverse a lot of the original's aspects that haven't aged very well, including, you know, the savage natives
a little racist, just a smidge.
The whole idea of King Kong as this kind of like figment of fear of this like brawny other from this kind of bestial other who captures the blonde woman, runs off with her, falls in love with her,
right?
Peter Jackson's King Kong does not try and sand off any of those edges. It kind of just leans into them until it becomes this like outsized creation. The movie is definitely too long. I think that's fair to say.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that some of the effects, which are really, like, you know, prime at their time, have not aged so well. But I do think that the things that Peter Jackson does well in terms of just, like, world building and visuals have, and King Kong, you know, as acted in motion capture by Andy Serkis, is a great creation. Like, he is this really kind of convincingly expressive, alive, thoughtful creation, in addition to being a scary one. And while I still mostly love in this movie the giant kind of Freudian-looking insects eating people, I do love this version of King Kong as well. And the particular the moment when, like, way into the movie, when he has broken free and is running through New York, he and Anne, played by Naomi Watts, have that moment on the ice, you know, in Central Park. Very poorly chosen, I think, in terms of just should have gotten away. But it's a, like, enchanting moment. And so, you know, if I, this is a movie that I don't feel like people talk about that much, which is why also seeing it in Ready Player One, being chosen by either Spielberg's personal connection to Jackson,
right,
or
their buddies,
their
that
buddies,
might be the reason,
or corporate synergy of whatever sort, that, you know, someone can choose to have it live on in, you know, global memory this clearly. I kind of appreciate that. You know, if Ready Player One is going to conjure up a world of kind of artificial nostalgia like this, then why not lean into it and have someone really, you know, push hard for their personal favorites? So King Kong, streaming on Netflix right now.
The only other thing I would say about it is that it's, that movie is itself nostalgic because, sure, you know, it's like Peter Jackson's, like, ultimate vision of the movie he loved as a kid, but like not as good as it was in his mind, like trying to make the King Kong he imagined as a kid.
Right. But also wanting to make it bigger and better and newer.
Well, exactly. But, like, you're right. Make it like the movie that it should have been all along, and, like, embracing this thing that he loved as a kid. So in a way, it's like the most fitting King Kong to put in a movie about nostalgia.
Because it's someone looking back for something they can never quite grasp.
Exactly.
Fair enough.
All right. I have a hard time believing it, but apparently I have somehow never mentioned my second pick on the podcast before. It is Last Action Hero, the Arnold Schwarzenegger film directed by John McTiernan. It's probably in Ready Player One, even though this is not a movie people are generally nostalgic for, because it was co-written by one of the writers of Ready Player One. So maybe he's nostalgic for it specifically.
He might be.
He's nostalgic for the paycheck he got. It's Zach Penn. He wrote the story for Last Action Hero before the screenplay was reworked by Shane Black. And at the time, Last Action Hero looked like it was going to be this dream team of early 90s blockbuster filmmakers. You had Shane Black at the absolute hottest he ever was in his career after the first couple of Lethal Weapon films. You had John McTiernan coming off of Predator and Die Hard and Hunt for Red October. And you had Schwarzenegger, who had made the improbable transition from evil robot in The Terminator to kind-hearted robot who's the champion of children in Terminator 2.
A movie that is also referenced in Ready Player
that
One.
That is correct. It is. But that movie I have mentioned on this the podcast, not surprisingly. So that's why we are doing Last Action Hero. So T2 and a couple of comedies Schwarzenegger made in the late 80s and early 90s, Kindergarten Cop and Twins, basically opened him up to this whole younger, new audience, and Last Action Hero seems like it was made as a concerted effort on his part to actively, like, court that family blockbuster audience that he had already cultivated. He plays Jack Slater, the title character in a string of popular action movies, whose world, fictional world, is intruded upon in Purple Rose of Cairo-esque fashion by this magical ticket, which winds up in the hands of Danny Madigan, this little boy who's played by Austin O'Brien. He uses this ticket to step into the movie screen in his local theater and then join Jack Slater on an adventure. And then later, Slater and Danny exit the movie and come into the quote-unquote real world. And much of the comedy is about the friction between how things work in the movies, where guns never have to be reloaded and action heroes never get hurt and you can punch through a pane of glass with your bare hands, versus how things work in the real world, where it's rainy and cold and you have bills to pay and your mom's never around because she's working, and it's very easy to hurt yourself and so on and so forth. It's a very interesting premise for an action film, and it gets even more interesting when Arnold Schwarzenegger shows up in a second role as himself, as the guy, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who plays Jack Slater in all the movies. And the fictional Jack Slater actually confronts, quote-unquote, Arnold Schwarzenegger and accuses him of being a bad guy. It's a scene that I still think is maybe the most interesting thing Schwarzenegger has ever done, particularly because this is a guy who consistently has played these fictional heroes, these superheroes practically, who is in real life, although he was the governor of a state for a couple of years, basically a screw-up, you know, ruined his marriage and all these sorts of things.
Sure.
So I think all of that is super, super interesting. The main problem with the movie is Austin O'Brien. No offense to this adorable child who is very annoying and very obnoxious. If I had to guess, I would assume that the movie was written like, you know, we're going to get Macaulay Culkin because this is made right after Home Alone. He was at the height of his sort of fame. And then they couldn't get him, and so they went a long way down the list until they found this kid. He's just not very good. He's not very interesting. But the movie is worth seeing in spite of him. And regarding how it fits with Ready Player One, they definitely have some shared themes, which could be partly because they are co-written by the same guy. These are both movies about people who literally become part of the popular culture they love. They're both partly critiques of this kind of obsessive, borderline deranged fandom. They're about how fantasies are fun, but they can be dangerous because they distract us from the way the real world works. On the other hand, both of the movie's messages are very severely undercut by the fact that the fictional worlds are fun in both movies and beautiful and well shot and well made. And the real world in both movies is dingy and dirty and overcrowded. And so you're told that we should want to live in the real world while being given extensive evidence that it's way more fun to live in, whether it's virtual reality or fiction in either case. So it's sort of this weird disconnect. And I think it's interesting that kind of both movies have that sort of same problem with what they're trying to say, I think. Plus, Last Action Hero was expected to be like the hit of the summer of 1993 because of its killer pedigree, and then it got destroyed at the box office. Do you know by what film, Allison?
I do not.
By Jurassic Park.
Wow.
A film directed by Steven Spielberg. So there are a lot of ways in which these two films are actually simpatico. I actually think they would make an excellent and very interesting, if flawed, double feature when Ready Player One is out on home video eventually. So that is Last Action Hero. It is available right now for rent or on Showtime. All right, we haven't seen any new movies to talk about. Avengers doesn't screen until next week when we are recording this. We haven't seen it yet.
And I didn't see I Feel Pretty.
We haven't seen I Feel Pretty, which is the new Amy Schumer comedy. So let's just go right to Behind the Eight Ball. That's the segment we do at the end of each show where we give you some new releases on streaming. We give you some listener recommendations that you guys have sent to us at our email address, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. And we also give you one film we each have chosen blindly by number from one another's My List on Netflix. Allison, who's going first this time?
I'm going first.
All right. So let's start with three new releases on streaming.
Okay. New to Tubi TV recently is 24-Hour Party People, a great favorite of mine. The 2002 film from Michael Winterbottom, Steve Coogan playing Tony Wilson, head of Factory Records, and the whole Manchester scene of the kind of late 70s and the 80s up in Manchester. And also just a very clever and funny self-referential film in which characters speak to the camera and challenge the narrative that's going on, that becomes kind of a movie about biopics in that, you know, Steve Coogan's character is always trying to tell you what his character's grand arc is, and the movie keeps failing to really comply with that. I love it. It's free on Tubi TV with ads. You should check it out. New to Amazon is Saturday Church. This is a 2017 film that I think was at Tribeca last year. Damon Cardassus' film about a 14-year-old in New York who finds sanctuary at this group for LGBT youths, and I guess maybe not just youths, at a church every Saturday. I pointed out in particular because if you are interested in Ryan Murphy's upcoming FX series Pose, about the kind of ball scene and voguing, the whole kind of scene that was documented in Paris is Burning, that a lot of the same actors who are stars of Pose appear in Saturday Church. So if you want to see them before the series starts, you can find it, this film, streaming on Amazon. And finally, on Hulu is Lost in Space. You may have noticed that Netflix did its own Lost in Space recently. Mm-hmm. I have not looked at it yet. Mm. They're also streaming the 90s movie.
They are not.
They absolutely are.
Oh, boy.
Yes, the one where Gary Oldman gets turned into a spider person, as you do.
It Matt happens. LeBlanc is in there.
Matt LeBlanc is in there.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly what I remember about it. Mostly I remember the spider.
Had a really good pinball game, I can tell you that.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that was a movie that happened. But if you want to indulge in the original Lost in Space, it's on Hulu. All 80-something episodes are there. The started in black and white, went to color. So yeah, you can do it. You could basically lock yourself away for several weeks, or at least a full week.
You could get
just,
lost.
Like, lost in Lost in Space. Yes. Don't do that to yourself, though. You know, take time to go outside.
Self-care.
Yes. But that is on Hulu.
Okay. How about two listener recommendations?
Okay. We got two, ones from Amy and one from Reed, who are both in the same town in North Carolina. So I'm going to assume the same household. The first one is from Amy, who writes, I would like to recommend the 2014 supernatural romance Spring. Set in a beautifully shot Italy, a young American falls in love with a beautiful, quaint seaside village and, more importantly, the mesmerizing young woman played by Nadia Hilker. Or rather, she seems like a young woman but has a supernatural secret which threatens to drive Lou Taylor Pucci's Evan away or kill him if he stays. To be honest, I would gladly face mortal danger to spend a summer in that village with that woman. It's also very romantic and idyllic. Sorry, that is, I think, from Amy. The second recommendation is, I think, from Reed, who recommends They Look Like People, which is streaming on Netflix and Amazon. Reed writes, I found out about this small horror gem from the Flophouse podcast, those guys over there, and always sing its praises to horror fans. Two old college buddies meet when one of them is on the run from a demon and possibly preparing to thwart a demon-fueled apocalypse, possibly. A great film about testing the limits of friendship with some real creepy, haunting scenes. So thank you for that, Reed.
All right. And how about one film chosen by the by now from your list?
You gave me number 15. That is Veronica, which is another horror film. It's one from Paco Plaza, who directed Rec and Rec 2, some very scary Spanish horror films that were remade into slightly less scary American horror films. But this one is set in Madrid in the early 1990s, and it has a teen girl minding her younger siblings in her home. After holding a seance at school and something evil maybe enters their apartment. It's apparently like based on this true story that happened where something bad happened after a girl used a Ouija board. So
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, I got to be careful with that. But that is Veronica, and it is number 15 on my list. It's on Netflix.
Okay.
All right, Matt, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, give me three new releases.
Okay, first up on Netflix is Kodachrome, a Netflix original, or at least an acquisition Netflix made at Toronto last year that I actually liked. It's a drama starring Jason Sudeikis and a very good Ed Harris as an estranged father and son who go on a road trip together when Ed Harris's character is dying to go get some undeveloped rolls of Kodachrome film developed at the last place in America that is still developing Kodachrome before they close forever. And while this story and the relationship is fiction, the place is, or spoiler alert, was real. The movie is inspired by a New York Times story about this place that closed a few years ago. That was like the last place that developed this kind of film. The movie is not, you know, revelatory. It's a fairly standard road trip movie in some ways. Road trip movies tend to be pretty formulaic. But I thought Ed Harris was really, really outstanding in this movie. Probably won't get any awards consideration, one, because the movie is coming out in April, and two, because it's a Netflix movie, and I think probably is just disqualified at that point. But he's really, really good in this movie, and if you're a fan of his, for sure, this is worth checking out. So that's Kodachrome on Netflix. Next up, I want to give a crossover nod to our listeners who also enjoy our sister podcast, Film Spotting, who are enjoying their, I think, recently wrapped up Vincent Minnelli marathon, to let them know that Filmstrunk currently has a whole section of movies dedicated to Vincent Minnelli. A lot of my favorite Vincent Minnelli movies have been on Filmstrunk for a while. Among the ones that were recently added, I will recommend Lust for Life, a 1956 biopic of painter Vincent van Gogh, featuring a typically very intense performance from Kirk Douglas in the lead role. And Vince Minnelli was such a bold director in terms of his use of color, that he is really just a perfect inspired choice to make a film about a painter. So a better than average biopic, Lust for Life, available on Filmstruck. Finally, the movie I want to be watching this week is the unauthorized Saved by the Bell story, which is available now on Hulu. This is a fairly recent Lifetime movie about the sordid details of the life on the set of the classic 90s television show Saved by the Bell. Frankly, there should have been a Saved by the Bell reference in Ready Player One. If they're nostalgic for the 90s,
yeah,
that's really kind of a key text.
There's not a ton of TV in there.
No, that's
which
true.
Which is mysterious.
That is true. Well, people don't like television.
It's definitely not in ascendance.
No. So Saved by the Bell, yeah, it seemed like a very wholesome, family-friendly sitcom for children. But in fact, apparently it was a den of sin, the likes of which has never been before seen in Hollywood or something. I haven't seen this movie, much to my chagrin, but I am dying to watch it because it just cracks me up to no end that they made the unauthorized Saved by the Bell story. And I have seen every episode of Saved by the Bell, for sure. The original recipe, say, but not the new class.
Oh, yeah.
That's garbage.
Well, of course.
Talking about
Does it even need to be said?
No, hopefully not. But that is the unauthorized Saved by the Bell story, which is now streaming on Hulu.
Okay, give me two listener recommendations.
Our first comes from Chris. Chris writes, as always, big fan of the podcast, and I wanted to send along a streaming recommendation. I had once sent you a recommendation for Kelly Reichardt's Night Moves, streaming on Hulu, and it looks like they are still in the Kelly Reichardt business, as Meek's Cutoff and Wendy and Lucy are streaming there as well. Kelly Reichardt is a filmmaker I really enjoy because of the simple stories she tells and the emotional depth in them. I hope more people can appreciate her work with these movies now available. So that's a recommendation for Meek's Cutoff and Wendy and Lucy, two excellent films streaming on Hulu. And that was a recommendation from Chris. Thank you, Chris. Our next recommendation comes from Justin in Portland, Oregon. Justin writes, this will act as a double recommendation. Ooh, since I don't think I would have known about either film had it not been for your show. I caught up with Los Angeles Plays Itself based on one of your recommendations and thought it was great. But the film I really wanted to recommend, which I don't think I've heard mentioned on your show, was used as part of a sequence in Los Angeles Plays Itself, and it really caught my eye, leading me to rent it on Netflix. That film is Jim Jarmusch's Night on Earth, which tells the story of five cab rides all taking place at the same time in different parts of the world. The interesting use of time zones helps create the feeling that we're moving later and later into the night while still reminding us that all five stories are taking place at the exact same time. It's a movie that's all about how people connect with each other or fail to. And it gets a little more raw and intense as we move from one story to the next. Once it's over, you've taken a seamless trip from a sunny evening in LA to a bleak Helsinki morning with stops along the way. Couldn't believe that both of these films flew under my radar for so long. So I hope this recommendation will have others like me searching them out. So that is a recommendation for Los Angeles Plays Itself and Night on Earth. That was from Justin. Thank you, Justin.
All right. Give me one chosen blindly from your my list.
You gave me number 17, so I had to count all the way to 17. That was brutal. Number 17 on my list is Our Souls at Night. Our Souls at Night, another Netflix film. After widowed neighbors Addie and Lewis begin sleeping in bed together platonically to alleviate their loneliness, a real romance begins to blossom. I believe the pair, it's Robert Redford and Jane Fonda, I believe. I have not watched this one. It was written by Scott Neustadter and Michael H. Weber, who are writers I like. They did 500 Days of Summer. They did recently The Disaster Artist. So it's sort of an odd fit for them because they usually tend to write about younger people. This is obviously based on that cast, a movie about some older characters. Have you seen it, Allison?
Nope.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who has. Maybe someone will write in and tell us they have and tell me if I should bump it up my list.
I do enjoy the title.
Our Souls at Night.
It has a grandeur to it.
Our Souls at Night. Our Souls at Night.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my pick. That's my list pick. Let's get to our listener's choice options for our next episode. Three very interesting films here. Very diverse set of films. I have the first one here. It is available now on Hulu, and it is called Loving Vincent, the 2017. It's described here as an experimental animated biographical drama film about the life of painter Vincent van Gogh. There's a lot of Vincent van Gogh on this podcast here. Maybe we could talk about Lust for Life some more if this was the winner. Anyway, it's a film about Vincent van Gogh. It's about the circumstances of his death. It is a quote-unquote fully painted animated feature, a Polish production funded by the Polish Film Institute, partly funded through a Kickstarter campaign. Very critically acclaimed film.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure quite what else to say about it. We could do two animated films in a row. I don't think that might be unprecedented.
That would be cool. I would like to do that.
That would be unusual on this podcast, but it is an option.
Sure.
So that is option number one, Loving Vincent, available now on Hulu.
Option number two is also now streaming on Hulu. It is Thelma, which is a 2017 Norwegian film from, I think it's Joachim Trier, who has made some films I've really liked, including Reprise in particular, but also Oslo, August 31st, both great films. I didn't love his English language debut, which was Louder Than Bombs, as much, but it did have a great cast. This is him trying something a little different. It is kind of in the realm of supernatural drama and also some horror. And it's about a young woman who leaves her kind of very religious and strict household to go to school in Oslo and meets and falls in love with this other woman and then starts discovering maybe some mysterious powers. I have not seen this movie. Have you, Matt?
I have not.
It was one that I think a lot of people were fans of. It kind of flew under the radar last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this would be a great opportunity for us to get to see it.
Yes.
And I don't know. There's a whole realm of different things I think we could talk about based on that premise. But I'm not going to say them now because I'm always afraid that I'm going to suggest something we've already done. Because we keep terrible records of what we have already done.
Yes, and we've done 162 of these.
Yes. All right, well, that is your second choice, Thelma, streaming on Hulu.
All right, our third option, God help us, is The Week Of, which is going to be streaming on Netflix. This is the latest film from Adam Sandler. It is the fourth, and as is described here, the fourth and final in the first four-film deal between Adam Sandler's company and Netflix. It will be available on Netflix on April 27th. The premise is the film takes place in the week leading up to Adam Sandler and Chris Rock's characters' children's getting married. So two families coming together. The father of the bride and the father of the groom are Adam Sandler and Chris Rock. Rachel Dratch is also in the film. Steve Buscemi is also in the film. I would say the reason to be hopeful that this movie is a cut above some of the other Adam Sandler Netflix movies or Adam Sandler movies in general when he's not working with a a Paul Thomas Anderson or a Noah Baumbach or something like that, is that this movie is directed by, it's actually the feature directorial debut and co-written by Robert Smigel, who is a very talented, very funny man. Of course, the creator of the voice of Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, a longtime collaborator of Sandler's. They've worked together on a lot of movies, including some of his better movies and some of his not so great movies. But I think Robert Smigel is a genuinely funny, very, very talented guy. I actually didn't realize until just recently that he directed this and co-wrote it with Adam Sandler. So to me, that's a cause for curiosity and hope. I would be disappointed. I'm never, I guess, that disappointed or shocked when an Adam Sandler movie isn't great.
Right.
But I'm going to be more disappointed if this one isn't, just because Robert Smigel is the guy sort of behind the camera here. And I'm very curious to see what he does as a first-time director. So that's option number three. The week of, streaming on Netflix on April 27th.
Okay, now it's all up to you. Tell us which of these streaming movies we should review. Okay, and now it's all up to you. Tell us which of these streaming movies we should review on the next episode by voting in the poll that's at the bottom of the page over at filmspottingsvu.com. We'll also post links to the poll on our social media feeds. We're at Facebook and Twitter at filmspottingsvu. You've got until Monday, April 30th at noon to vote. That's when we'll announce the winner, and that gives you about a week if you want to watch it in advance before our next episode comes out on Tuesday, May 8th.
In addition to being able to vote at filmspottingsvu.com, it's also where you can find our episode archive, complete with links to where you can stream or rent all the titles we mention on the show. The Filmspotting SVU Remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Find more of Vince's work at vincevandal.bandcamp.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more recommendations and the review you pick. But until then, follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore, at Matt Singer. And you should definitely also follow the show at FilmspottingSVU. That's where we drop links throughout the day to things that are new to streaming that you might want to know about. For Filmspotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.